everyone, and welcome back to the Nextlander Watchcast. We are back, and we are fully submerged in sub-month here over at the Nextlander Watchcast. That is not some sort of euphemism for trying to get more subs over on Patreon. We are literally watching submarine movies. And previously, we watched ourselves The Hunt for Red October, and now we have moved further in to other films featuring the color red on the poster and submarines in 1995's Tony Scott thriller, Crimson Tide. Vinny Caravella, Brad Shoemaker, as always, joining me. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
Also, don't lie. It's just the same poster as Red October.
It really is.
Actually just the same.
Drew Scanlon, once again, joining us as well for sub-month. Welcome back, sir.
Hello, reporting for duty.
Happy to have you here as my XO. Please do not mutiny me and take over the show. This is all I have.
No promises.
So, 1995, Crimson Tide. This is a movie that is a Jerry Bruckheimer, Don Simpson movie, if there ever was one. My God.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know. Okay, first of all, I'm just going to establish a policy at this point. Of any movie I haven't seen, I'm going to know as little as possible going into it. Because I had no idea Jerry Bruckheimer had anything to do with this movie. And 5 seconds in, I was like, oh, it's going to be that kind of movie.
Yeah, what was you the hear tip the military horns.
Well, seeing its name.
Yeah, okay.
it's literally the first credit on the screen is like Jerry Bruckheimer production or whatever.
Yes, this was one of the last films that Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer produced together before Don Simpson died of a drug overdose a year later. It was Dangerous Minds was the last one he did while he was still alive, the Michelle Pfeiffer movie. And then The Rock was produced the next year with Don Simpson's name on it posthumously. Hmm. So this is like the last of the big action thrillers that he and Bruckheimer produced together. And boy howdy, this sure is one of those.
Holy shit, man. I don't know where to start.
Well, let's start. You know what? Here's where we're going to start. What is our experience with this movie? Brad, obviously you had not seen this before, so I'm very interested in your impressions. But before we get there, I just want to know, Vinny, do you remember where you were in the world when you saw this movie?
Where was I in the world? I probably saw this around the time it came out. Mm-hmm. This is mid-90s, right?
95,
yeah. So I was a teenager, you know, probably 16 or 17. I saw this. My memory of this was Tension. And yes. I don't think but I thought there was much more, and we'll get into this a little bit later, much more overt racial tension happening continuously on the boat. But that was my memory of it. I remember the horses stuff. That was I thought that like was an undercurrent the entire movie. And maybe it is, but it's not as overt watching it again. It's like, you know, it comes up here and there and one scene very, very particularly. But I thought the whole time, the entire movie, I was kind of rewatching it, waiting for me like, wait, when does he just kind of declare that he does not like Denzel Washington on this boat?
It's a thing that only really comes up in like the quieter moments of the movie, and there are maybe 4 of those total in the entire nearly 2-hour runtime.
my other thing I'll just say is, watching it again, I totally had the same jolt of memory of, what is it, EAM?
The emergency alert
action
message.
And like being like, even when I saw it at the time, I was like, I have no idea what this is. This is a real thing, but they are using this plot device a lot in this movie. It is the entire plot, I guess.
It's practically a character.
Yeah.
Drew, yes. Where were you in the world when this movie came around? When did you find your way to it?
I think I had always heard, you know, this and Hunt for Red October said in the same breath, and that this one was not as good. And so I think I just always avoided it for that reason. But I finally just, my curiosity got the better of me probably 10 years ago. And that was the only time that I watched it. So it was good to see it again.
Yeah, I would agree with the sentiment that it is not as good as Red for Red October. But there is a thing that it is doing as an over the top action movie that I think is extremely watchable and extremely enjoyable. I saw this movie probably I did the math. I think this may have been one of the very first movies I ever saw with my dad after my parents got divorced, because we started doing the divorced father-son thing of every other weekend we go to a movie, you know, hang out for a day or something. And I think mathematically, this may have been one of the first things we went and saw after that, let's just say, less than fun part of my childhood. But I have a fond remembrance of going to the theater and being blown away by this thing when I was the tender age of 14. So,
heck of a dad thriller.
Yes, absolutely.
It's kind of it is kind of a powerhouse of close quarters acting. Like, there is,
dude. I am just going to say this right now. This is my favorite thing we have watched for this podcast so far.
Really?
Okay.
Wow.
I am not going to sit here and pass judgment on whether it's the best thing we have watched, but it is the thing I had the best time watching.
It's
and about 90% of that is down to Denzel Washington and his performance.
Yeah. He's great. I think Viggo is great in this. I think Gene Hackman probably could have been swapped out with anybody, some other people, but I think he's good in it.
He's good. He's doing Gene Hackman thing. Like, is he always an asshole? Like,
no.
Does he ever play roles where he's not an asshole?
Sometimes, like, some of his stuff in the 70s and 80s are a little less, like, Gene Hackman is definitively the dickhead, but like, you know, he has a certain energy that I feel like lends itself toward that kind of role.
So, God, I'm trying to think where to start with this. Like,
well, give me your first impressions. How do you feel?
I will say it's weird. It's weird to me now, knowing this gets lumped in with Red October. I have to assume that's mostly just proximity of release. Like, it's, hey, they similar movie posters, both about subs, both like post Cold War, like Russian aggression type stuff. Like, they're such different movies to me, though. Like, having seen both of them recently, like, Red October feels like a movie or a story written by a war nerd. Like, it's way about, like, maneuvering subs against each other and, like, tension of ship versus ship. But, like, there's generally, like, a lot of crew cohesion on every side. Like, there's not a ton, unless I'm completely blanking on something, there's not, like, a ton of dissent in the ranks in that movie other than the saboteur.
Right.
And that's all this movie is. Like, this is nothing but people in the same crew butting heads and mutinying against each other constantly. And like, it was that challenge of authority that was so exciting to me about this.
I think there are no less than three major swings in terms of who is in charge of the boat at any given moment. Like, it just, it's like a, you know, a heavyweight prize fight where they're just throwing haymakers at each other. And then, you know, it's like they keep staggering each other until they get to the end. And then there's a standoff.
So like, the Bruckheimer thing was not just, I mean, when I saw it, it was like, okay, this is going to be a thriller. This is going to be an action popcorn summer thriller type thing. But also I was like, this is probably going to be a little jingoistic, isn't it? Like, I was just bracing for a bunch of rah-rah American military shit. And for that reason, it took me a while to decide for sure if the movie was trying to paint Gene Hackman as a villain or a good guy. Like, even up to the conversation, this is like maybe the best scene in the movie, like the dinner in the wardroom where they're talking about Clausewitz, and Gene Hackman is going on about how good it was that we dropped the atomic bombs. I couldn't tell if that was a position the movie itself was also taking or not. Like, even then I was like, where is this going? Like, maybe I was just assuming too much about like the Bruckheimer, Michael Bay style of, I know Michael Bay had nothing to do with this, but you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, because, like, I mean, the thing is, like, this year, 95, was also the year that Michael Bay did his first movie for Bruckheimer and Simpson, which was Bad Boys, and then he went on to do The Rock the next year. And, you know, so, like, this was, I mean, Tony Scott kind of was their Michael Bay for a while. Like, he, you know, Top Gun, Days of Thunder, like, he is, you know, one of the greatest action directors of all time. And, like, he, you know, in this period, he was kind of doing what eventually became Michael Bay's thing for Bruckheimer. And, but Tony Scott, I feel like, other than Top Gun, which is a little bit more rah-rah military, Tony Scott has never really been that guy. One, I assume because he's British. And two, it just feels like he's only interested in telling a good story. He doesn't really care about the politics that much about what's going on here. Like, he's interested in it from the tension standpoint. He doesn't really care how it makes the U.S. Navy look.
Okay, that's fair. So yeah, like, it was, some of that was like expectation, knowing it was Bruckheimer and stuff. I wasn't sure if the movie was ready to like actually challenge American foreign or military policy. So I was very excited when that extremely tense dinner conversation happened.
I mean, but it is still, you know, it's 95. Like, there's a point in there where they lightly joke about the possibility of maybe it wasn't a great idea to drop the atomic bomb. And then one of the guys immediately fires back, "What are you, a communist?"
And it's like, that's the tone of the conversation.
Yeah.
I think this one, when I was scanning through some stuff, this the military didn't, Navy did not like this one, right?
No. So the production of this movie, so this is written by Michael Schiffer, primarily, who is a screenwriter that wrote Lean on Me, Colors, went on to write The Peacemaker, also three Call of Duty games, the first three Call of Duty games, Call of Duty, Call of Duty 2, and Call of Duty Finest Hour. But it was co-written, the story was, with Richard P. Henrich, who is a military novelist. I don't know of what regard. I'd never really heard of him before. But he's written a bunch of books about, you know, U.S. military stuff. And the initial pitch to the Navy for this movie was that it was about a sub-crew that was trying to stop a fictional computer system from launching World War III.
War games.
Yeah, basically war games. Like, they were saying that there was a computer on the sub that was going to launch the nukes. The Navy brought them aboard the USS Florida, to basically tell them, this is implausible. We don't have any systems like this. This isn't how this works. Here are the procedures in place that would prevent a sub from launching its nukes without everyone being on board, which you can see very much in the final product, what they learned from that. So they took that, and they came back with this mutiny plot line, which the USS Navy was like, well, fuck this. We don't want anything to do with your movie. We're not going to help you at all. And that mostly didn't matter, because all this was done on set. Similar to the Red October thing that's on a hydraulic tilting set. You know, a little more, I think, advanced than what Red October was doing, but very similar. But to get the shots they needed of actual submarines, they literally just flew out to Pearl Harbor, did the research to make sure it was legal to film actual naval launches. It was. And they filmed the actual USS Alabama leaving from Pearl Harbor and submerging for the one shot of a full sub in the movie.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, beyond that, like, there's not too much other trivia about this movie. Quentin Tarantino did some rewrites on this movie that are uncredited. You can definitely hear it in the pop culture dialogue that makes its way into this movie.
Yep. Oh,
the Silver Surfer stuff.
The Silver Surfer stuff, the Robert Mitchum stuff, like...
Star Trek stuff.
The Star Trek stuff, definitely. That is all Tarantino.
Who played the German sub-commander in The Enemy Below with Robert Mitchum? Was it Kurt Jurgens or Hardy Kruger?
Do you understand?
Yes, sir.
You have to set an example even in the face of stupidity. Now, everybody that reads comic books knows that Kirby Silver Surfer is the only true Silver Surfer. Now, am I right or wrong?
You're right, sir.
All right, get out of here.
Yes, sir.
You ever watch Star Trek? Star Trek, you know, Star Trek, the USS Enterprise. All right, you remember when the Klingons were going to blow up the Enterprise and Captain Kirk calls down to Scotty? He says, Scotty, I got to have more power.
He needs more warp speed.
Warp speed, exactly. Yeah. Well, I'm Captain Kirk, you're Scotty, I need more power. I'm telling you, if you do not get this radio up, a billion people are going to die. Now, it's all up to you. I know that's a shitty deal, but you got it. Can you handle it? Scotty.
Hi, Captain.
So, okay.
Yes.
So you kind of have a weird cast here of very young Hollywood stars strutting around. I did not remember, or maybe this was before James Gandolfini was a household name.
I mean, this is pre-Sopranos.
Yeah.
So you have a very young James Gandolfini who kind of, in my mind, maybe plays the biggest asshole in whole movie.
Oh, easily. Mm-hmm. Well, like, I don't know. Gene Hackman is the asshole.
You get the sense that Gene Hackman is. I feel like the movie's trying to portray Gene Hackman as the old school by the book. You know, there's a gray area here where James Gandolfini is just kind of like an asshole lapdog or a attack dog of Gene Hackman at some point. James Gandolfini is the one that goes to spring Gene Hackman out of the room and like kind of really set things in motion. But you have Viggo Mortensen in a very like, you know, Viggo role of quiet contemplation and staring longingly at people, and sad Viggo.
A tremendous amount of weight on his shoulders, as he is the guy that basically has to say, okay, the weapons are ready to fire, go.
Yes, he's the weapons officer, right?
Yes,
he's the only one that knows the combination to the safe. It's got like the firing trigger in it or whatever. What happens if something happens to him?
Yeah, that must have been invented, right? Because if he got hit in the face with one of which is the most devastating part of this whole movie.
Oh my god!
If he gets knocked out, like what happens?
Maybe there is another person, but that person is part of the other mutinying group. Who knows?
Maybe his name is not Wep right?
It's Webb.
They kept calling him Webb.
Well, no. So
maybe
his,
it's short for his.
Sorry, say
station.
Again?
You know, maybe it's short for his station. You
that's
know,
what I thought.
I think that's the case because he has a different name in some of the credit lists I see, and then Webb's is also his station. Yeah. So.
Okay. Like comms, Webb's. Okay.
Suppo. Mm-hmm. For supplies, apparently. I looked this stuff up. That's apparently what they say.
Nice.
And is the radio operator the guy who's trying to fix the radio operator? That's
like, it's Mr. Rossetti.
Who is it?
Oh, that's the sonar operator. I swear they were calling him Mr. Rossetti.
It did sound like that a couple of times, yes.
There's the guy who's, he looks like, I know the ages don't light up, but who's the guy, kid who plays Spider-Man now? Is it Todd Holland?
Yes, Tom Holland. Like,
it was really giving me Todd Holland vibes. And
you're talking about the radio guy, the guy who has to actually fix the radio, right?
Yes, yes.
Oh, that guy.
With the giant eye gash.
Yes, okay. With the big eye gash the entire time. I know, like, it's 20 years before that could be Tom Holland, but it really had vibes.
He's a babyface kid, and that's the thing. Yeah. I think they actually do a good job here, is that, like, they draw a very clear distinction between the experienced enlisted, officer men, and these dumbass kids who are just sailors. They've probably been in the military a couple of years at max. And, you know, they're being thrust into what is, you know, the worst case scenario for if you are a sub, you know, sailor. Like, your job is to eventually deliver nuclear missiles, which you never actually want to have to do. Right. And in this case, the plot is that a Russian rebel sect has sort of stormed parliament and has taken over a military base in southern Russia, and they are threatening to launch nukes at various targets if their demands are not met. Right out of the gate, it is difficult to take this insurgency seriously because the guy who plays Brochenko, I think is what they call him.
Yeah.
Is the guy who plays George's dipshit boss on Seinfeld, Mr. Krueger. So it is like, okay, no, you're George's boss. You are not a Russian dissident. I'm sorry, I can't believe this.
So I think the movie bookends with a CNN reporter who is not Wolf Blitzer on an aircraft carrier.
A French aircraft carrier.
Basically setting up doing exposition with a microphone on an aircraft carrier as the planes are taking off. And when the sub goes underwater with Gene Hackman and the new XO Denzel Washington, which they make it sound like, do they say explicitly like, oh, he like runs through XOs? What do you say? Yeah. Oh, this one's got a, what is it?
The last one had appendicitis.
Oh, appendicitis. It's like kind of like sneer quotes, right? And so he auditions Denzel Washington, but when they go underwater, the dissidents have the nuclear launch facility, but they don't have the codes. And then the Russians in power say they have don't worry, they have the codes. You're going to go underwater. We're going to put you in position if something happens. And that's basically where the kind of whole thing starts.
And within a fairly rapid fire amount of time, like, they start getting these messages being like, hey, we're now at DEFCON 2. Hey, you need to basically get your missiles ready to launch. And then in the midst of that, they also start engaging with a submarine, a Russian submarine, that is one of the four that have been taken over by the rebel military sect. And so they are essentially, one, trying to stay out of the way of this ship while also trying to maintain radio contact to make sure that their orders stay before they actually have to launch.
I think they do a really good job of setting up the technical plot device this whole thing turns on, like, through repetition, because they show an entire drill of it once, right?
Yeah,
and then they drill it again.
They drill it.
Oh, wait, is the drill in the middle of the fire the first time they run that drill, or is it the second time? I can't remember.
I believe that is the first time.
Okay, so yeah, like, I mean, this is kind of both things happening in tandem. The other thing is, okay, let me back up. This movie made me realize I have seen Denzel Washington in like maybe one or two other movies.
Really?
Like,
oh wow.
I just don't watch a lot of the type of movies he went on to do a lot of, like The Man on Fire, like Training Day. Like, I have not seen any of it's just not something I have seen a lot of. Like, I've seen him in Glory.
Okay.
So he slow rolls his performance so much that I was like wondering, like, is this just how, like, is this just a Denzel Washington thing, or is it a this character thing that he's very reserved and taciturn? Like the cat, like Ramsey, that's the Gene Hackman character's name, like, calls it out at one point when he takes him up to watch the sunset. And he, like, you know, he just is kind of a man of few words for a lot of the first half of this movie. to the point that he's like, good, you need to shut the fuck up and just enjoy the sunset.
It's my favorite part. Right here, right now. Bravo, Hunter.
Sir?
You knew to shut up and enjoy the view. Most eggheads want to talk it away. You stocked this one up a couple points.
Thanks.
Anyway, all of that is to say that when it got to the point that he actually started pushing back against authority and, like, really allowed his, like, moral conscience to take over, it was just, like, such a big fuck yeah moment. But yeah, they build to that really well with, like, he has to go help put out a fire in the galley, and he's literally still in the fire suit, trying to make sure the fire is all the way out, and people are super injured, and then Ramsay orders a fucking missile drill in the middle of that, and I was like, okay, is he just, like, trying to stress test his crew, or is he trying to haze this guy? Like, what is going on here?
Yeah, that's, I think, and maybe this is kind of what you were alluding to, Vinny, but that's kind of the first third of this movie, or at least the first third of the time that Ramsay and Hunter are together. You're not really sure if what this movie is going to be is like a whiplash situation where it's just like, you know, the guy with the authority is hazing the newbie. And then also this is going to be a post-Cold War thriller. And I thought that dichotomy was really well executed here. And you know, with the Bruckheimer production and the Hans Zimmer soundtrack, it really does feel at first blush like one of those kind of dumb action movies of this era. But I think with the script and with Tony Scott at the helm and with these performances, it really is more of a subtle, not a thinking man's movie, but you know what I mean? There's
it's
like
a thinking man's action
than that
movie, I feel like.
Yes, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. Because here's the thing. You could see this script being like a Golan Globus production in the 80s or like, you know, some other like lower budget, like kind of action thing from the 80s and early 90s. And it would be nothing but just like jingoistic bullshit and also just like constant sub action. Like, this actually kind of gets to the meat of an interesting idea, at least, even if it's done in a way that I would not say feels 100% authentic. But at the same time, it is at least broaching an interesting subject, which is the idea of this chain of command, the ways in which it can be breached in a high-stress situation like the one that they are in. And, you know, I mean, it's all kind of laid out there with the, you know, the fact that in order for the missiles to be launched, both the XO and the captain have to be in agreement on what the orders are and what is about to take place. And that's even irrespective of confirming the message, you know, going through the coding system and all that. Like, if one of them says no, then basically the whole thing breaks down. And it breaks down with Gene Hackman being a guy who sees no room for a gray area and says, this is the order I have. This other order we got, which is partial. They get this other thing that's like, you know, partial message that might be it. Maybe it's the confirmed kill order, or it could be a stand down order. They don't know. And he's like, it doesn't matter. The only orders I have that are complete are these ones that say launch these missiles
at
this time.
That's the standing order.
Yeah.
Oh, he's so full of shit. He is so fucking full of shit. Like, your commanding officers have tried to send you another order and you know it, and yet you are insisting on taking an action that is essentially sure to, or very possibly going to end human civilization. Like,
yeah, but as Viggo says, you know, this guy has been on boats for 25 years.
Right.
You know, he doesn't live in the real world.
Yeah, he's been in boats for 25 years. He's fought the Cold War, like most of it.
That's the other part of the character dynamic I think we need to fill in here, is that they make it clear pretty early on he is the salty old sea dog and a huge fucking warmonger. Like, that conversation at dinner about how gung-ho he was about dropping the atomic bombs is part of building up to, like, the reality that he is just fucking horny to launch some nuclear missiles. Like,
yes.
He fucking wants to launch nukes.
He definitely, like, acknowledges, like, we are a first strike vessel, and we are here it's not even, like, to prevent war. It is, like, we are here to strike first at our enemy to defend the United States. That's what it's
right.
like. It's, yeah.
Well, no, there's a specific line in there where he's like,
we're here to preserve democracy, not to practice it.
and that is a line that apparently Robert Mueller used when he was head of the FBI fairly frequently.
So the other, the flip side of that dynamic is that Hunter is quickly made clear to be like a top of his class, like academy guy.
Yeah,
but
has never seen combat. Like, right, like knows the philosophy of war inside and out. Like clearly has a strong like moral backbone. Has never seen combat before. And in a worse movie, or even in a more just like generic action thrillery movie, like you said, like I feel like the movie would denigrate him more for not having like the combat experience, for not having been in the shit. But like he is pretty quickly clearly made to be the hero here, because he's like he's like the rare example of like a super tough officer who like wants to avoid war at all costs, who like understands the cost of nuclear conflict.
And like
in the, at the end of that dinner scene, what makes it so tense is that he basically says, I think the true enemy is war itself.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In the like nuclear age, like in this modern age.
Yes. In the nuclear age, the real enemy is war itself. And like that does not go over well with the captain at all.
War is a continuation of politics by other means. Von Clausewitz.
I think, sir, that what he was actually trying to say was a little more
complicated.
Yes, the purpose of war is to serve a political end, but the true nature of war is to serve itself.
I'm very impressed. In other words, the sailor most likely to win the war is the one most willing to part company with the politicians and ignore everything except the destruction of the enemy. That you'd agree with that?
I'd agree that that's what Clausewitz was trying to say.
But you wouldn't agree with it?
No, sir, I do not. No, I just think that in the nuclear world, true enemy can't be destroyed.
Attention on deck. Von Clausewitz will now tell us exactly who the real enemy is. Von?
In my humble opinion, in the nuclear world, the true enemy is war itself.
There's also an interesting part of Gene Hackman's character where he has the loyalty of his crew. Like the crew really respects him, and he makes himself out to be someone who is dogmatic by the book. Mm-hmm. Like he is by the book. I follow the rules. The rules are there for a reason in the Navy. You follow the rule. Like he admonishes Denzel Washington for talking back in front of the crew, because they need to have a chain of command. Don't undermine me in front of the crew. We're by the book. And when it comes down to it, he has to go outside the book to get his way, because Denzel Washington does not agree to launch the nukes and has to replace him. And I feel like that's an interesting part of the story, because some of the crew, who's very loyal to Gene Hackman, only sides with Denzel Washington because they also want to be by the book. It's something I feel like they are following Gene Hackman because he's by the book. This is old school Navy. Don't use your gut. You go by the book. And when he has to circumvent the book, they have a problem with that, which was interesting. Which is an interesting part, if not just a plot device to get some people on Denzel Washington's side, because he is kind of the academic. But I thought it was an interesting way to do it.
I mean, that personality type exists, though. I thought that was really cool to have some people like that, you know, that are like
a begrudging.
He goes up to the chief of the boat after the first of like three mutinies happens. If you can even call it a mutiny. I mean, it was by the book in that case, but like he goes up to him to thank him for like backing him against the captain. And he's like, fuck you. Like, I don't support you. Like, I only support like the rules of the Navy.
Yeah.
Like, you might be wrong. Like, you might be dooming the world right now. But I cannot break the rules. Like even for the captain that he is like super loyal to, he's like, I cannot. Like, I put the rule book above even my own loyalty to this man.
Chief of the boat,
sir.
Thank you, God.
Thank you. Fuck you. Get it straight, Mr. Hunter. I'm not on your side. Now you could be wrong. Just replace you at will. That was completely improper, and that's why I did what I did, by the book.
I thank you anyway.
Like, I appreciated having some people like that around.
Yeah,
yeah.
That was interesting. The other part that's a little funny in it, or you're like, oh boy, is when Gene Hackman does, they lose the transmission. It comes in partial because they're diving to a depth where they want to launch the missiles. So they go, they put up the extra long antenna, but they can't get the whole message. And so Denzel Washington's like, well, float the buoy, like launch the, float the radio buoy. But the freaking winch jammed on the buoy. Not only can they not get the radio signal, it makes this horrible screeching sound. And like the enemy sub is in the area and does like a
yep.
turns around.
An exclamation point appears above its head.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
Dude, I'm trying to save this for later. Maybe I should just throw this question out now and we can return to it. How many times has Hideo Kojima seen this movie?
Minimum 10 times.
Because holy fucking shit, there were like 5 different scenes or moments in this thing that I was like, oh, oh, that's where he got it. Like, there's a shot at the beginning on the base before they put out to sea of guards in ponchos on a military base in the rain that easily could have been out of the first two Metal Gear Solid games.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Oh, that like, shot is one of the most, that is like the most parodied shot from this movie. Like, that's okay. That's the one that appears in the Simpsons episode that does a parody of this. Like, it is an iconic scene of Gene Hackman giving his little speech and then, you know, trotting off with his little dog. The dog, by the sure. way, blameless in all of this. Nothing
he
to love
pee
with the
in
dog.
The boat, though. That's
Gene Hackman's problem. He needs to figure out a better solution for that.
I would go further and say it's fucked up to bring a dog.
Yes.
The submarine.
Yeah.
Fucked up before the dog.
Well, his wife left him, so the dog's all he's got.
That's fair. But I actually meant literally just one like establishing shot on that base of dudes in ponchos in silhouette in the rain with spotlights on them and stuff. But like the score, the... like numerous shots of the submarine really remind me of the intro from MGS1. Like stylistically, like so much of this movie is in that, especially that first Metal Gear Solid game.
Yes. Even I'll go as far as to say, if you take some of the racial overtones over the horse thing, the like kind of sitting like kind of a super tense moment with two people having a philosophical discussion over something is also very Kojima of like, oh, the world could end in about 45 seconds. Let me tell you about lizards. I'm going to tell you how lizards lose their tail.
Yes, like let me tell you about all the time I spent on the lizards Wikipedia page.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, you're right. I hadn't even thought of that. So the thing that I took away also, this sub that is hunting them, is it the
Akul class or something?
Akula
yeah.
class. Akula hunter class. Killer.
Yes, I like that name. They go left, they go right, they launch their countermeasures, it misses them, and Gene Hackman kind of saves the day there, and they're okay, and they have their little mutiny, but that they come back
around.
They have
their little mutiny, come on.
They have their, so he gets, Denzel Washington takes over the boat, not everybody's happy, but only Gene Hackman gets sent to his room at that point, and they put some guards in front of the room.
Yeah.
And then you know, kind of they try to launch the buoy's there when Gene Hackman's there because he kind of gets mad, I think, after that sound happens and he's very upset.
Yeah.
But that I read one of the things I was reading when I was looking up this, when they're yelling at each other, when this is the part, Brad, you were talking about, when Denzel Washington turns on and starts yelling back at Gene Hackman, I think somebody gets the name of the boat, of the submarine wrong, the numbers backwards, like according to, you know, USS 7323, and somebody says it's 732 or something backwards, which I thought was pretty funny. I mean, because they're just yelling at each other.
You've been reading the goof section on IMDb, haven't you?
You know, I wanted to look some stuff up because it's really tense, and there's a lot of military stuff going on there. I had to look up, like, is this how this would go? I'm going to fast forward a little bit because at the end of the movie, there's a little blurb that's like, this is not how this goes anymore. With the
right. The U.S. president is now the only person who can launch a nuclear strike from anywhere.
Yeah. So there's some stuff I wanted to look up, and there's, you know, there were some goofs and trivia things that I was one person did comment and say, once you're on the submarine, everybody puts coveralls on, and it's not just the officers wear their like fatigues and then the crewmen wear the coveralls. But it was like, interesting visual thing for the movie because they do separate out the crewmen and the kind of officers a lot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But Hunter, so Hunter is the one who has their ear. He's the one who has, you know, he's able to walk between,
that's
you know,
right.
the crew
so he's
and
a man
the officers.
Of the people.
Yeah.
It's a little heavy handed, but he is definitely, there's a scene where he's like, the crew to Gene Hackman, he's like, the crew's on edge, man. We got a, you know, I think morale is kind of low, and Gene, you're not really sure where it's going to go. And Gene Hackman's like, oh, the morale's low, huh? Oh, okay. Hold on. Let me get the microphone. And yeah. It is the most dick thing in the movie. Maybe the most dick thing in the movie where he's like, hey, Hunter's saying morale is kind of low. If anybody wants to get off the submarine, get off now. Otherwise, get back to work. We're not here messing around, people.
May I have your attention, please? Mr. Hunter has brought it to my attention that morale may be a bit low. That you may be a bit...
on edge.
On edge. So I suggest this. Any crew member who feels he can't handle this situation can leave the ship right now. Gentlemen, we're at DEFCON 3. War is imminent. This is the captain. That is all.
Very inspiring, sir.
It was, what a dick. That was, I think, the moment where I was like, okay, this... You're an asshole.
At that point, it starts to become very clear. Like, okay, yeah, this guy is the villain after all.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
Yeah.
Thank you, movie, for not being that shitty.
Denzel can't ask a question on the bridge, but he can basically just fucking give you a ream of shit over the intercom anytime he feels like.
Yeah. The whole movie turned on that scene where it comes to blows.
Yeah.
Rhetorical blows at that point. But, like, again, like, Denzel had been so reserved for most of the first half of that movie that when he explodes on the bridge and they really get into it, I was like jumping out of my seat, man.
It's good. I mean, I think the setup is believable. Like, yeah. I think the setup with the old sea dog who has been waiting his whole career to push the button to launch the nukes is like, I've got the order. You're not going to take this away from me. And the kind of, you know, in the movie, the academic who is like, let's think this through. I mean, because he also says there are other boats or there are other subs in the water. It, like, you don't have to do this. Let's confirm.
Yeah.
You know, I think they set up a plausible chain of command issue, at least.
Yes.
Which sets up a pretty good tension. The movie falls apart a little for me on the, like, trips to the gun locker during the, carousel of mutinies.
We'll get to that stuff and all the things that take place on the boat here in just a second. But for right now, we need to take a quick break. So we will be right back. And we are back. So we have our premise. We have our setup. We know what the stakes are. And now it is about jostling for power on this boat. Gene Hackman is, he has been relegated to quarters. Hunter is now in charge of the boat. Things are kind of going sideways. They have a pretty good knockdown, dragout, like, final confrontation with that Russian sub. I'm going to say right out of the gate here, I feel like the sub action here feels a little less geared toward how stuff would actually go in a sub battle, in the sense that, anyone who's an expert here, feel free to chime in, but I feel like the way Hunt for Red October portrayed stuff like countermeasures and evasive maneuvers and stuff, there was never a guarantee that any of that stuff would work, that it would never, like, there was no sense that, like, a countermeasure would actually cause a torpedo to lose much contact with a sub, especially if they aren't able to evade properly. Here, it's like, anytime they throw the countermeasures, those torpedoes just start going all squiggly, and it is just kind of all over the place.
Red October, go ahead.
Yeah, Hunt for Red October, it felt more like, they were using countermeasures, but they also had to do something else creative to, you know, to outsmart the torpedoes.
The sub operations generally in that movie are much more interesting and more tense and more effective than they are here. Like, if this movie had more ship-on-ship combat than it does, it would be a dramatically worse movie, because, like, it's very cartoonish in this, and I'm glad they just dispense with it as a plot mechanism pretty quickly here. It's like, okay, this is actually just a vehicle to damage the ship badly and put them into a bad situation, which creates more tension in the crew and not so much like sub combat for its own sake.
Like, there's a great bit in there after the last torpedo is fired off by the Russian sub right before it gets blown the fuck up, which, by the way, great implosion in the ocean scene there.
Oh yeah,
pretty good. I assume that's probably what would actually happen to a sub if it, like, just straight up exploded in the water.
Yeah, that looked good.
Yeah. But, so, they lose propulsion for a little while, and they are straight up sinking to what, I guess, crush depth for that sub is 1,850 feet. I, again, don't know if that's accurate or not. I assume someone did the math. But the entire time while they are slowly drifting down, like, the crew is, like, freaking out.
It's a nightmare scene.
Yeah, and you can kind of tell who's gonna, like, fall on which side or not, depending on how they're reacting to this stuff. The more reactionary types are probably the ones that are gonna go along with Gene Hackman in the end. The ones who are cooler, maybe gonna go alongside Hunter, and it kind of bears out that way. There's, like, one radio guy who's like, what are they doing? Why aren't they fixing this?
Like, he rips
the other guy's
his
like, shut
off.
The fuck up! They're working on it!
I mean, I agree with Vinny. Like, that scene, like, I mean, the way it's going until they save it at the last second, I mean, those people are all about 90 seconds away from dying and they know it.
Yeah.
And like, it's, yeah, it really comes through with the way that some of them lose it in a pretty gut wrenching way.
And
it's two ticking clocks at the same time. Cause not only are we getting deeper and deeper, but the Russians have launch capability in 39 minutes. So there's pressure to do both things.
A lot of pressure outside.
Numerous
pressure.
Ticking
a lot
clocks.
Of pressure.
There are, like, some nice outside shots of this unpowered sub just drifting to the bottom of the ocean, which are terrifying.
Yeah, it's spooky.
Yeah, and, like, you're just, in my mind, was like, oh my gosh, what are the chances it just doesn't smash against the bottom of a rock or something? Like, if it just touches anything.
It looks like it's going to a couple of times.
And it's just kind of listing. It's just terrifying. It's extremely unsettling. And, of course, it's a movie, so it's, like, within a hair's breadth of being,
I think, about 20 feet from crushed death.
It's
you
know, before the engine just miraculously spins back up. And
but also, like, maybe the most grueling thing in the movie, because they have sent a damage control team down to try to stem the leakage that is causing them
in
to
the
lose
bilge,
propulsion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a very very contrived cinematic thing, but, like, they're down in whatever that area is trying to stop the leak. Whatever the sequence of events is, they have to close the hatch that is the access to that area in order to restart propulsion, and there's no way for them to essentially, it's flooding down there, and they can't both be there and fix the problem and also get out before the hatch has to be closed at the same time. And it becomes clear very quickly that Hunter is going to have to order them to their deaths.
Yeah.
Like, he's going to have to order that hatch closed while they're still in there in order to save the rest of the ship and basically kill those men. And then that, like, whatever the metal part is, blows off and hits the guy in the face in the course
Steve
of all
Zahn
of this.
Steve Zahn takes one to the dome.
Oh my
Holy
gosh.
Shit,
he
so
loses his face.
RIP Steve Zahn, man. You took one for the team on that one.
So they, like, and they show him underwater. Just
that,
like,
shot, like, he gets it in the face and it's, like, incredibly, like,
yeah,
it's just a very violent visual. And then, yes, there's the shot after that of his body, like, lifelessly floating underwater with, like, blood pouring out of his face, man. It's rough.
It's a tough shot. They do. It's weird. Okay. So, when I was watching it, it seemed like the flooding was going to spread if they didn't close the hatch, unrelated to starting the prop back up. But there's a guy there who's like, I can't close the hatch. You know, like, I can't close the hatch. They're in there. I'm not saying this isn't merciful, but they do seem to let him off the hook because it seemed like everybody had kind of drowned by the time they closed the hatch, where in some movies, they, you know, the guys are banging on the wall when they have to close the hatch and get out of there. He's yelling to him, like, get up. But by the time he closes it, the water's bubbling out of the hatch, and they seem to have drowned in there, which is a mercy. Yeah. They don't make it as horrible as maybe they could have that scene.
But at the same time, like, they also let the guy who has to close the hatch off the hook, too, because he is shouting at them for almost a solid minute, like, yo, you're off the, get out of there now.
They've made it clear to him that they are not leaving.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or can't hear him, or it's futile, right? It's
whatever it is, they're not going to make it.
They're gone. And, you know, Gene Hackman also, or the movie sets that up earlier where, it's when he hands him over the key after the first, quote-unquote, mutiny, where he's like, you've never had to make the tough call. And you're like, oh, okay, this is...
They immediately throw the tough call at him.
Yeah, this is his tough call moment. But yeah, the prop starts back up. They're a second away from being crushed, or it feels like it, and then it's a pull up.
I mean, there's also more of a dynamic there where it's made very clear early on that Hunter cares about the men and Ramsey does not, because Hunter goes down to bodily put out that fire. He throws the fire suit on and gets right in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And then Ramsey calls the missile drill and pulls him away and gives him shit for being late and blah, blah, blah. But then one of the crew members involved in that fire goes into cardiac arrest and dies. And Ramsay straight up fucking talks shit about the guy who died after he died.
Yeah.
Like being too fat. He's like, oh, the fire didn't kill him. His 300 pounds did. You know, yeah. It's like he doesn't give a shit about his own men.
Right.
So how tough a call is it actually?
Right.
Given that fact, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. I didn't even put that together. Right. Yes, he's kind of callous in his way where, you know, I don't know. Maybe Denzel needs to have the edges sanded off, maybe he needs to become a cold heart to run that sub. But he proves. I mean, the movie's I think trying to prove that you can have a human run this.
Right.
You can still be a human being.
You can be calculating without being completely dispassionate.
Yeah.
They do humanize Gene Hackman's character a little bit by, like, you know, in those quieter moments, he does sort of explain his reasoning. He's not just like a one-dimensional character, which is, again, something that I feel like this movie does more than a lot of other action movies. You know,
yes.
Like Ed Harris's, reason for threatening San Francisco with VX nerve gas makes very little sense.
No.
But this at least, you know, I can understand a person like this.
Yeah, the movie they set up is the last full message they get is that the Russian dissidents are fueling up their missiles, getting ready to launch them, and if they can launch their nukes first, might stop them from launching their. They have a ticking clock for what's the time the dissidents can get their missiles launched. So in Gene Hackman's mind, every minute wasted is a chance for them to do a first strike, for the Russians to do a first strike against somebody else. So his character thinks, hey, by not launching our nukes, we're going to allow them to get the first strike on us, whereas it's our responsibility to kind of wipe them out before they can launch nukes. We're gonna, I think he also really wants to push that button, but yes.
That's where he's crossed over to me, is that, like, obviously everybody's the hero in their own mind, right? Everybody has got like unassailable motives, and yeah, he wants to avert nuclear war or stop the United States from getting nuke or whatever it is. But like that kind of violence, like to be a true hero, like that kind of violence needs to be lamented, not celebrated, right?
Right.
And it's become the end unto itself for him, where like that kind of thing should be the option of last resort, and instead it's the thing that he is desperate to do, even when there's like pretty clear reason to, like, dude, hang back for 10 minutes and go get this message that you got half of and figure out what the fuck's actually going on first.
Yeah, I do really enjoy the sort of game theory aspect of this movie. Yeah. Like, we're stuck on the sub as an audience, just like they are. Like, there are no, it's not like Hunt for Red October where you're jumping back and forth between the surface and, you know, different boats and stuff. We are stuck there. It's like, it's kind of like 12 Angry Men, you know, in one room, essentially. We don't know what's going on outside. We just have to, you know, figure it out. And I think that's one of the movie's stronger points. And that plus, you know, you take that and then you add the sort of like personal psychological thriller between Denzel and Gene Hackman, and I think it's the thing that I sort of forgot about this movie. The thing I thought going into this was that there was some twist at the end, like you would, like it was all a training exercise, or that Gene Hackman was actually insane, or I kept waiting for something to happen, but it was more subtle than that, and I think I have to commend the movie for that.
It's about as subtle as Tony Scott ever gets in his career, which is, you know, I'm not saying that, like, I love Tony Scott. He is not Michael Bay. Like, that guy mostly makes, I think, action movies that are a little more thoughtful and a little more interesting than what most people of that era did. But also, he was big on the bombast and big on the crazy action and tilted camera angles and all that stuff kind of doing the work for him. But I do think that the story here, like, the fact that they do keep it so grounded on this primary, which is an incredible story. Like, it is a story about the worst possible things coming to pass or potentially coming to pass and the stress around that and the way he kind of maintains what feels relative humanity with these characters who are a little bit better than just cardboard cutout archetypes of, you know, like action movie sailors, and just the pure visceral thrill of everything going on, I think is really deft. I think it's like some of the best work of his career.
Yeah, it's I think like Citizen Red October subdrama is a very claustrophobic.
Yes.
It's, everybody's sweating in this thing constantly.
Some more than others, but everyone constantly. Yes.
There's a lot of like, there's nowhere to hide. You can't just go into another room. And I think they do a good job of sticking that camera up in people's faces constantly.
Yes.
Even when
some really good close up tilted angles with the cinematography here.
And I think it works for the tension. I mean, we'll fast forward a little bit because after they get out of that predicament of not being crushed, now their comms are down. Like they had damage to the boat. So now even if they wanted to, they can't communicate.
Right.
And I think that's when James Gandolfini goes and is like, I'm going to see my captain. And busts his way into the quarters, and Gene Hackman's ready to go. Like
he's just sitting there with his dog, like basically just like, ah, finally, you're here.
Hackman.
They veer a little bit into the archetype of the like wise and cultured military leader sort of guy. Like this is a random comparison, but like Grand Admiral Thrawn from like some of the Star Wars shit is the same thing of like, oh, this guy is such a wise and educated tactician. Like, he appreciates art. Like, he listens to Mozart in order to, like, strategize in his battles. You know what I mean? That kind of shit. Mm-hmm. Like, they've always got him, like, with, like, classical music on in the background, and he's literally sitting there wearing a sweater and, like, reading Hunter's file.
Yes.
Which was a little bit more of that gamesmanship that Drew was talking about, I guess, of, like, he's really, like, trying to unpack Hunter's psyche while he's stuck in his stateroom or cabin or whatever. To like try to get inside his mind and figure out how to subvert him.
Sir, how bad is it, Mr. Dougherty?
It's bad, sir.
I've just been looking at Hunter's file here. Closest to combat he's been is a policy seminar.
Give me an order, sir.
As quietly as you can, you get to Mr. Zimmer and Mr. Westergaard.
How about Linkletter?
Nah, you won't be able to talk to the TSO. He's at the con. But you can get to Weps. We gotta have Weps. He's the key. You get me those men, a small security force, then come back and get me.
Aye, sir.
Don't get overzealous now and try to recruit the whole ship. Lead from the top down.
Aye, sir. Right away.
Yeah. No, and then, no military, no combat experience. He's just an academic.
But that's the thing, is that like that, and again, another version of this movie, the roles are absolutely reversed. Like, Gene Hackman is the old sea dog that no one is listening to, and Denzel Washington's character is the sniveling, you know, Harvard-educated XO who's never touched, you know, a gun in his life right. And outside of training, and has never seen real combat. And that guy gets his comeuppance at the end when the real sailor comes through and says and knows exactly what he wants to do. And it is to the movie's credit that it does not go that route, because there's a very easy version of that story to tell.
Like, I think I would have hated that movie. Yeah.
Yes, me too.
Like, I would have despised that. But really, I mean, when it comes down to it for me, like, it's less about background than it is moral character in this movie. Like, I am a sucker for the type of character that Denzel Washington plays in this movie. Because the same reason I like Jean-Luc Picard so much, like, a character with, like the utmost respect for the sanctity of life and also the like unflinching moral backbone to like abide by those principles, you know, like absolutely no matter what is like, I mean, I get that it's like fairly naive and optimistic.
Oh yeah.
There are not a lot of people out like that out there in real life, but like, that's why I like seeing a character like that, or I find a character like that so inspiring.
Yeah. And with the exception of maybe Gandolfini, most of the other crew again are like human characters. Like Viggo Mortensen's character, who's Denzel's friend, you know, succumbs to pressure to help the mutineers, and then, you know, gets convinced by Denzel again not to turn the key.
Don't turn your key, sir.
Like, yeah. He recognizes that there are arguments to be made on either side here, and he's very torn because he sees the procedure and he sees the reality, and he's trying to figure out what to do. And it does go back and forth a couple of times.
Yeah, there's a lot of good character contrast. I was thinking the same thing, that like he also has a conscience and knows what Ramsey wants to do is wrong, but he can't stand up to the pressure, and he buckles and goes along with the second mutiny.
Yeah.
Where Denzel did, right. Like you're kind of mad at him, you kind of feel bad for him, like you kind of respect his conscience at least, but like Denzel is the flip side of that, where he will not buckle to any pressure no matter what.
And Denzel sees the mutiny coming and uses his special powers of being a man of the people to seed the keys. He puts the keys in the hands of one of the crewmen. He kind of talks to, you see him like kind of talking to everybody like, hey man, this is going to be here. This is going to be here. And I thought, once the mutiny happens and they go to launch the missiles, I actually really like the scene where Viggo won't open the safe. And so Gene Hackman has to go down. He's going to launch that. He turns his key at the helm or whatever, and he goes down to go launch him himself. And it's where Gene Hackman has fucking lost it. It's where he pulls the gun on Viggo Mortensen to be like, well, and he's like, shooting you does nothing because you're the only one who has the codes, which is ridiculous. But and then he points the gun at another crewman who's sitting next to him and is like, I'll shoot this guy. And the movie and everybody in that moment and Gene Hackman also recognizes.
Yeah, that's the snap moment. Yeah. There's nothing left there.
Everybody recognizes that it's gone too far. Even Gene Hackman's character, Ramsey, is like, because I think Viggo is like, sir! And he's like, Jesus, all right. Just
you're
fucking.
Right. I'm fucking up here, but also fucking open
fucking
that
open
safe.
Fucking open the safe. Yeah, yeah. Like, okay, I just pulled a gun on somebody.
Mr. Ince? Mr. Ince, remove the tactical firing key.
Sir, it is my duty to...
Son, don't talk to me about duty. Open the fucking safe!
I can't do that, sir.
I'm gonna count to three, and then I'm gonna blow your fucking head off. One. Two. Me no good to kill you. You're the only one who knows the combination. However, to the officer, Hilaire doesn't know the combination. Millions of lives at stake here, Peter. Don't make a dumb decision. One! Two!
You know, he doesn't back down, but it is a moment where the acting is in the close quarter stuff is very tense, and you kind of realize everybody knows this is fucking off the rails. But then I thought maybe a little Hollywood with the second trip to the gun locker and the great escape happening where Denzel Washington needs coveralls.
Look, the radar man is still very much on Denzel Washington's side. Like, he wants to help. The guy who is guarding Denzel Washington is the guy who disagreed with him about Silver Surfer, yes. So he has no love lost there. Again, that Tarantino shit. It is just like, knowing it's him,
mm-hmm.
It really does stick out. Like, not in a bad way, like, it's not awful writing, but it is so different from every other piece of dialogue in that movie.
It feels like nobody believes what they are saying. Like, no.
Kind of.
Except for the part where he's doing the Kirk Scotty thing with the radio guy. I feel like that was like the one that was like, okay, yes, I can see how this would relate. I can see what you're doing here. But the bit where they're arguing about Jack Kirby or Mobius, it's like, fucking come on.
Yeah, it was a little bit much. Did you know that the guy on the other side of the Silver Surfer beef is Leonardo DiCaprio's best friend from Titanic?
No.
That is him.
Yeah. What is he, like, the head of sonar or something like
he's
that?
He's the sonar guy, yeah.
He's basically the head sonar guy.
He's Jonesy, from Hunt for Red October equivalent.
I really got on his side when one of the dipshits next to him, like they draw a good line between people who are, like, on top of their shit and want to do their duty correctly, and the ones who are just shoot from the hip, like, belligerent assholes.
Mm-hmm.
It was when they fired the torpedoes at, or no, they're backing away from the Russian sub to fire the torpedoes at it. And the guy's losing his shit. He's like, why is he backing away? Just shoot him. And he's like the torpedoes need 1,000 meters to arm. How the fuck did you get on this boat, you dipshit?
I think he literally said, who did you fuck to get on this boat?
Sonar, Khan, let me know when our range to that cooler is open to 1,000 yards.
Khan, sonar, aye, sir.
God damn it, let's just shoot this fucker. What's 1,000 yards for?
Because it takes 1,000 yards for the torpedoes to arm. Jesus, who'd you fuck to get on this ship?
Right.
Oh, really? I don't know if I even caught that. I caught that. Right. I thought he said, how did you get on this boat?
Like, it's just the contrast between, like, the assholes and the people with extreme competence is really fun.
Yeah.
The
he's very good at yelling. the sonar operator.
He is. Like, it's very good, intense yelling, but also that character, like, manages to avoid becoming, like, an annoying stereotype. Like, he's the gung-ho young guy, but, like, he's actually very sympathetic, I feel like, through most of that movie.
I just want to point out that they are pretty flexible with what it's like on a submarine here. Mm-hmm. Like, the fish tank, crawling around.
Oh, the guy who has the fish tank, yes.
Right. You're not getting a fish tank aboard a submarine. Crawling around in the crawl spaces of a submarine, I don't think there are any of those.
No?
There's probably a reason why they didn't show that.
The gym. There's a gym on the submarine?
Yeah, I think that's also...
Wait, is there a gym? I thought he was just kind of doing exercises.
No, he's got a punching bag.
It's a weight bag hanging there.
Oh, that's right.
I think that's also pretty good because it shows that he could kick Gene Hackman's ass at any point in this movie, and Denzel is like very reserved.
And chooses not to.
He's extremely reserved. Because also Denzel Washington in this movie is in fucking good shape. This is like, he is ripped. Because they show him with his shirt off quite a bit. And then like, he's like, no, they show him on the heavy bag. They show him sparring. They show him running around. And Gene Hackman is like, you know, not in good shape. But it is, and I think it is good because they show Denzel is like for the most part, cool, calm, and collected, like trying to make the academic argument, and Gene Hackman is barking at people.
Mm-hmm. But it's a good little bit of misdirection. I mean, we're not to skip ahead to the end, but like it does actually come to blows at some point where Hackman literally just decks him a couple of times. And like, because you've seen that stuff, it's like, is he finally just going to go off? He's going to drop him with one blow, but like he... You know, he maintains the high road even when he could just end this situation.
It's a very good part.
Because in the end, like, the thing is, he doesn't want command. Like, he's not here because this is a power play, and he wants to, you know, he wants to take Gene Hackman down a peg. He literally believes that this dude is going to end the world, and he just needs to make him see reason.
Yeah, so you get this kind of... So Denzel kind of takes the boat back, and then the guy's trying to get the radio back up. There's this great scene where he's like, how long is it going to take to get this radio back up? And the other guy just hangs up, which I really like.
He's like, look, man, I can't talk right now. I got shit to do.
He's just like so stressed out. I don't know what he's even doing, but he's trying to fix the radio.
Like all the really fevered shots of the guy soldering as fast as he can.
Yeah.
Really funny to me.
Like, I don't know what's actually happening.
He's like putting
there.
Video cards in that thing. I don't know what's happening.
A lot of static, a lot of like the screen coming back in for a second, then going back out. But they do get the radio up in a nice scene where Gene Hackman and Denzel are on. And Gene Hackman says, you're like, listen, I'll give you 3 minutes. Like, I will, like, it seems out of character because it seems like things have gone so off the rails. But Gene Hackman says, I'll give you 3 minutes to get the radio back up. And if we can't by this point, this is during the mutiny.
The last actual mutiny that happens, the one that ends in a standoff with like both sides just pointing guns at each other all over the bridge of the sub.
And then, you know, this is where they have their kind of tete-a-tete. They're like, their talk about, was it the Lippenzahners? The Stallions. And they're, it kind of all comes down to, you're an asshole. You're just,
they're all white, you know.
Yeah, right. And then the two things, they're from Portugal.
He thinks they're from Portugal and that they're all white. And then Denzel comes back and is like, they're from Spain, actually. And did you know, they're born black.
Speaking of horses, did you ever see those Lippenzahner stallions?
What?
From Portugal. The Lippenzahner stallions. Most highly trained horses in the world. They're all white.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. You're aware they're all white, or yes, sir? You've seen them.
Yes, sir, I've seen them. Yes, sir, I'm aware that they're all white. They're not from Portugal, they're from Spain. And at birth, they're not white. They're black. Sir.
I didn't know that. But they are from Portugal.
Yeah. Oh, because Gene Hackman's like, they follow orders, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
They're easily trained, or
it's not just a random factoid he throws out that they're all white. Like he really pokes him with it pretty directly.
Literally. I mean, he literally talks about jamming a cattle prod up the horse's ass at one point.
It's just a matter of voltage.
But also he really kind of like tries to rub Denzel Washington's face in that fact.
Yes.
Which like that felt a little out of left field for me. Like I feel like they either should have like built up to the racist element more throughout the movie or not included it. I get like up to that point, it seemed like the objection was entirely the challenge to his authority, unless there's something I'm forgetting.
No, there's a little bit of that beginning scene when they first meet where he kind of, you know, jokes around about his, you know, his Harvard history and how it was a short list of possible exos who he could bring on and whatever. But he never really gets into it. It's like, other than kind of mocking him for like liking horses, he does not really dig into that stuff. And then through the rest of the movie, there's no time for that because everything is about the insane feverish pace of what is taking place. So there really aren't any moments for them to have any kind of back and forth outside of that dinner scene where all they do is talk about, you know, the art of war.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I feel like I didn't necessarily need it, that extra bit of like, oh, you're an asshole, because his character was so developed into like, oh, I know what this character, like, we are very aware now what this character is. I'm not saying it's a terrible moment, because I think it's an interesting moment. And again, I think it plays better to Denzel's character, obviously, of being able to rise above even that bullshit. But like, you've already set up your confrontation. It's an interesting part. And so
it's a sneering kind of villainy that I feel like most of Hackman's character up to this point never really had, outside of like a couple of moments. Like it feels like leaning into the thing that he doesn't do for most of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely makes him into way more of a villain, like just a bigger asshole. Like, I guess one way to read it is just that, like, at the end of the day, that's all he had to fall back on. Like, he had to go for that. Like, he sank that low because he had nothing else, you know? Like, he just had to, like, get one over on this guy, or he had to dig him, give him another dig, like, that much deeper. And this was all he had left, was just to go to, like, you know, sheer racism, I guess.
Yeah.
Because he probably knows. I mean, he sort of alludes to this at the end of the movie, but, you know, Gene Hackman probably knows that he's right. That Denzel is right.
Yeah. Yeah. That probably happens like around the time that he almost shoots the crew member, right? Like, I guess at that point, he is like, everybody has seen that he's become a monster.
Right. Yes. And I'm trying to think if there's anything at the beginning where they're doing this speech, where Gene Hackman's doing the speech about, I mean, the name of the sub is the Alabama. And, you know, he's like, this fine state that, you know, a history of whatever. But I don't think I don't know if it's alluded to that there's anything.
I took that more as just like a generic rah-rah thing. Yeah. And, you know, like the roll tide thing is such a, you know, like just I'm playing to the cheap seats thing here of right, like, you know, yeah, no, Alabama, baby. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fucking Nick Saban, roll tide, baby. You know, like it doesn't feel like he's really trying to get at anything other than, hey, this ship is called that state. You like that state, right? Yeah.
Denzel even kind of smiles when they do the roll tide thing. So
yeah, it's very goofy, but I appreciate it. I think this might actually be one of the best named movies ever. One, because it has the Alabama, you know, like the Alabama Crimson Tide thing. Two, Crimson Tide, red ocean, blood in the ocean kind of thing. It's like also immediate association with Hunt for Red October, like just right there in the name.
Oh, I didn't think about that.
Yes. Yep. Like it hits the trifecta in terms of, well, I like that other sub movie. I should watch this one.
I mean, probably not coincidentally, they're both dealing in Soviet, kind of post-Soviet Russia here. With
the other one is just straight up Soviet. This one is like, this is that period in Hollywood where Hollywood had not quite figured out what its next villain country was going to be. So when they do use Russia, they're trying to tiptoe around actual Russian government to not piss them off, and trying to come up with like scenarios like, oh, it's Chechen rebels, or oh, it's this, you know, ultra-nationalist group or whatever. Here, they're really trying to walk a line here and trying to also make, it's the Russians, but it's not the Russians you remember. These are different Russians. These are the bad Russians. Right. The old these Russians are okay. It's these other guys. They're not cool.
I mean, because you still have a superpower that has the ability to take on the United States, but
but it's not the superpower that's doing it.
That's right. So yeah, they get the guy gets the radio up just in the nick of time.
It's a like, great triumphant little bit of scene there. Like the moment he is like excitedly saying, "We got radio, we got radio," is great.
Yeah, and then you know the message gets printed out, and you know it's handed off. Both of you know the two captains see it before we do, and they just exchange looks. Like they build up that tension really well.
Even though everybody probably has seen this message before it gets into the captain's hand, because it's on the screen behind the radio guy. The person bringing it there obviously read that fucking thing before. You know, it's
already
delivered
on sub Twitter.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
Everybody kind of knows, but yeah, they have this kind of quiet moment until Gene Hackman gives the stand down order, and then I think he relinquishes the boat, right? The captainship, the command, relinquishes the command to Denzel Washington.
I was afraid they weren't actually going to show the order. Like, I mean, obviously the net effect is that they don't launch the nukes, but I wanted to know like why not? Like, what happened? I want to know like how right was Denzel Washington, and thankfully. Thankfully, they do show, and it turns out that the rebels have surrendered unconditionally, like minutes after that first strike order was given. So essentially, they would have started World War III and or ended the world for nothing.
Shout out to that CNN reporter who basically does all the heavy lifting of explaining the background of what's going on, both at the beginning and the end of the movie. Yeah. He really just gets a long dialogue string of like, here's everything that happened off screen. Okay, bye.
Can you guys stop launching planes? I'm trying to talk to the camera here.
Yeah.
All right, back to you, Wolf.
They basically the rebels had a short little skirmish, and then
they had no appetite for fighting their countrymen.
Yeah, that's right. And they everything is back secured. And then you get the kind of denouement here, the kind of wrap up, which I did not love. It's
a little cute.
It's maybe not as satisfying as you hope, because they have the board, the Admiralty is there with Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington, and they're kind of going over it's not a trial, but they're kind of going over the case.
It's like a review board.
Yeah. And, you know, it just is like, this is where the kind of hammer hits the head on what they wanted to show, which is like, it could have gone either way. You know,
you're both right. And you were both wrong.
Yeah. And it's like,
And then he says, I wish I'd written down this quote, but then the guy said, like, you're both right, you're both wrong. And then he says something like, and that's kind of the whole deal with the military. So whatever.
Yeah.
Or you want a command?
Yeah. We're going to be chewing on this one for years and years to come. And like, you know, look how Blue flipped everybody's bean on this one. Like, oh my God.
My primary concern here is the breakdown in the system. In this instance, the system failed because the two senior officers did not work to resolve their differences while preserving the chain of command. Now, you may have been proven right, Mr. Hunter, but insofar as the letter of the law is concerned, you were both right. And you were also both wrong. This is the dilemma that will occupy this panel, this Navy, and this country's armed forces as a whole, long after you leave this room. Off the record, you've both created one hell of a mess, a mutiny aboard a United States nuclear submarine, violation of nuclear launch protocol. For the record, it is the conclusion of this panel that your actions aboard the Alabama were consistent with the best traditions of the Navy and in the interests of the United States. As such, the recommendations of this panel will be to accept, in a manner reflective of his long and dedicated service to his country, Captain Ramsey's request for early retirement from active duty, and based in no small part on Captain Ramsey's recommendation that Lieutenant Commander Hunter be given his next command at the earliest possible convenience. Unless, of course, you wish to challenge these recommendations.
No, sir.
Captain Ramsey.
No, sir.
Dismissed.
Coming straight off of Ramsay just going full racist, I was prepared to get very angry at that scene, because they started out by basically saying, like, okay, like, this hearing has reached its conclusion based on the testimony of blah, 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 Ramsay. And then Hunter jumps in and is like, without even hearing my testimony, sir. And I was like, I braced to get very angry, because I thought they were just going to hang him out to dry without him letting him even participate in the adjudication or whatever. But then it goes very Hollywood. Like, the ending is a bit more Hollywood happy ending than I expected, but like, at least he gets his due.
Yeah. At the time I remember watching it. I thought, I was like, oh, they're going to do the A Few Good Men thing, where it's like, yes, technically it's a happy ending, but also they aren't completely blameless, so there's still some kind of punitive action that takes place. It's not a, 100% rah-rah thing. But no, they go for the 100% rah-rah thing at the end. It's literally Gene Hackman is going to gently retire into that good night with his dog. And hey, anytime, Denzel, if you want a boat, it's yours.
Just
yours.
He has recommended Hunter for command.
Speaking of rah-rah. Oh, go ahead, Vinny.
Oh, I was going to say, they have to end with nobody being wrong. Even with the horses. They have to we were both right. We're both wrong. Even with the horses thing,
He was Denzel was right all the way about the horses.
I thought they were from somewhere else.
No. He said you're right. They were from Spain.
Just wanted to say thank you. You were right, and I was wrong. About the horses, the Lippensonners. They are from Spain, not Portugal. Yes.
That's that last exchange
is where he was like, I was wrong.
Yes.
About the horses.
Right.
Like, okay,
yes.
Fine. If that's the best you can do to admit you were wrong.
Yeah,
then fine.
That's right. That's the part that was like, oh, you're not even going to get like just one more like, fuck you. And then it's like just a laugh and walk away.
Well, that's the kind of asshole he is,
Yeah. Drew, what did you want to say?
Yeah, the one thing that felt a little also a little Hollywoody to me, and maybe this is just the time that it was made, but like when the radio goes up and we get the message that you need to terminate the launch, and then I think it's Hackman that says terminate the launch over the intercom, everyone cheers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is like, okay, that's what the audience should be feeling. Yes. But it was weird. Like, does everyone know the context of everything that has happened here? And that felt really odd to me.
It's a little odd. Staged. I feel like the sense there was that no one on that boat actually wanted to be the first nuclear submarine to actually launch nukes. Like, that was not really the thing, with the exception of maybe Gandolfini and Hackman. I feel like,
well, sure.
Everyone else is like, I don't want this.
I expected relief, I think, is really what I was expecting there.
Instead of everyone cheering and hugging and, fucking busting out the champagne. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Even to that point, Drew, I would say, with all that has happened with Denzel and Gene Hackman kind of swapping back and forth who's on the comm, you wouldn't even know what's going on, right? If you're okay, terminate the launch. Like, okay, who's in command right now? Is this
right?
Is this five minutes later, we're
going to launch him?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Don't get too comfortable.
Just a couple more random tidbits before we wrap up. There's a deleted scene on the Blu-ray that I was watching is of basically all the principals at Naval Headquarters waiting to each be called in turn to give their testimony about what happened. And they're all just sitting there on this bench, stone-faced, staring straight ahead, not interacting with each other at all. But then Vigo takes his turn going in, and then he comes out, and there's a good moment of he and Hunter exchange a glance, and then he very like shamefully just turns and walks out the front door without saying anything. Like he clearly is like, it's wearing heavily on his conscience.
Oh, like that didn't get repaired.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Okay. He took the coward's way out one more time of not confronting the fact that he buckled under pressure with him, and instead just kind of walks away and lets their relationship presumably
what
evaporate.
Was broken cannot be repaired.
Yeah. The other thing is I've randomly read the SF Chronicle. So, I love like alternate casting stuff, and I couldn't really find much for this movie.
There wasn't much, as far as I know.
I did read the SF Chronicle review of this movie from when it came out, though, and they mentioned in there that Brad Pitt was originally up for the Hunter role.
Huh.
Which the Chronicle reviewer even says himself, which would have destroyed the picture, is how he put it. which yeah. like, I can't really disagree with that.
Yeah. I mean, 95 Brad Pitt is not, that is before he is like the big deal Brad Pitt. Like he's big, but he's not like all the way big.
And I just don't think like, he can do crisp military yeah, man no, like Denzel no. can.
I have nothing against Brad Pitt. I like him in some stuff he's in, but he is not. I don't think he's half the actor that Denzel Washington is.
But that's the thing is that I was gonna say Brad Pitt is sometimes bad as an actor. I think he's good more than he's bad. Even in a terrible movie, Denzel Washington is never terrible. Mm. I don't think I've ever seen a Denzel, even the worst Denzel Washington movie I've ever seen. He is still interesting and engaging and doing something with the character that, you know, at least keeps my attention. And there just aren't that many actors like him.
His screen presence is incredible. Like when, yeah. you know, every scene he was in, you know, it feels intense. Like there's an intensity in every scene that is, you know, when he's not in frame.
Yeah. Everyone should be asking, where's Denzel? Because that's what the audience is thinking.
Yeah, yeah. No, he was great in this.
On the subject of alternate casting, I mean, this wasn't a thing they ever talked about, but I just, watching this movie now, after having just watched The Rock a few months ago, back when I was doing that Nicolas Cage article for IGN, this movie is really dumb Crimson Tide. Or The Rock really is dumb Crimson Tide. Like, they're not about submarine. The other one's not about submarines or whatever, but like the Ed Harris character is a much more over the top, scenery chewing version of the kind of military man that Gene Hackman is. The direction, it really does feel like Michael Bay is trying to do a cover of Tony Scott stuff. And I love The Rock. Don't get me wrong. The Rock is one of the greatest action movies of all time. But there are shots in that movie that feel like, including the, you know, the military base in the rain, like all the guys in ponchos.
Oh, yeah.
There's that beginning scene in The Rock that is basically that exact same scene, but in a different context. And the Hans Zimmer score is almost identical both movies. I thought they had stolen songs from this movie to put in The Rock after seeing them back to back. Great movies separate from themselves, but there is a lot that seems to be going on of like, oh, Crimson Tide seems to have done a lot to influence what they went with as far as producing The Rock went.
It's a nice thriller. I mean, it's
yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it's a.
I had a ton of fun with this at this time. Like, I actually think I like this movie better having sat there and watched it this time. Like, it had been a while since I saw it, and I think it is genuinely one of the best of the Bruckheimer Simpson productions of the 90s. Like, I think it is top flight, and you know, dumb and over the top in some ways, but yeah. like. Just a lot of fun and very, very tense.
It's over the top, and it definitely trades in like caricature somewhat or stereotype. Like it very much is that kind of blockbuster.
Yeah.
But there is a moral center to the movie that I really appreciate.
Yeah. Absolutely. And again, I keep harping on this. It's somewhat more believable than I think a lot of the other stuff that came kind of right after this, like the early 2000s. I don't think like there was a gulf, I think, between let's say this and probably the Bourne Identity, where I kind of mark that movie as like back to realism and away from the sort of bombastic Hollywood, like you'll believe anything, you're a dumb audience. Mm-hmm. This was in some ways kind of refreshing
for me. This one, I think it loses a little bit because I knew how it wound. I knew what happened.
Right.
At the end,
you knew
right?
what the end result would be.
Yeah. So it like kind of, it's, you know, there's a long way to go from when they get that first order to when the final thing resolves. That's the majority of the movie. And, you know, there's it's good. I think the acting is good, but it's a, you know, it's a thriller, and I kind of knew who the killer was.
Yeah, like the second the central conflict is set up that, hey, they are either going to launch nukes or not, like I was like, come on. This is a fucking Bruckheimer-related movie. Like, they are not going to launch nukes and end the world at the end of this movie.
Yeah.
Like, it was more how they got there for me. It was more... It was not... There was no surprise in how is the nuke situation going to resolve. Mm. All the surprise was in how are these characters going to butt heads and, like, who's going to stand up to whom. And,
yeah.
And that kind of... That's why the scene when Hunter takes command of the ship was my favorite part of the movie. That was the thing I did not see coming.
Yeah,
yeah, it's good. I think in my ranking, I think Red October, having just watched both of them, I think I put Red October above this one, above Crimson Tide. I think in the ranking of all the movies we've done so far, I'm going to say Jaws, Red October, Crimson Tide, Close Encounters.
Okay. That would be my ranking, personally.
Yeah? Okay.
Yes.
Poor Close Encounters getting
I have a slight more affection for Hunt for Red October just because, like, I don't know, like, I saw it at a time when it, you know, it was much more formative for me. Crimson Tide, I think, is just a really good, exciting movie. Like, I think it's just really good at what it does, and I think it comes together pretty well.
Exciting is why I'm so enthusiastic about it. And I'm not again going to, like, you know, pound for pound, like, weigh which one is the best film. It's just like, what was I the most excited watching at the time because I had not seen it before, and it was this.
Yeah,
Drew, as our sub expert, do you think that this is an accurate submarine movie in any particular way, or is this really just like they got some of the procedures right, but otherwise this is just a good old yarn?
I mean, I think it's a good old yarn, but I was so much more impressed with this movie than I thought I would be. I was expecting it to be just sort of like a lot dumber, I guess. And it's not. It's, you know, it's a very competent, well acted, exciting, tense thriller. And it was really enjoyable to watch.
Yeah, it's got a little bit of dumb in it, but it also has some ideas, which I think, you know, is a testament to a great action movie, is that it does make you think just a little bit.
Last thing I'll mention, I don't think we really covered this. Before the Navy soured on this movie, they were originally attempting to work with the filmmakers.
Yes, they were.
They actually sent out, who was it? It was
Bruckheimer, it was Simpson, it was Tony Scott, and it was the writers.
And the writer. All went out on a sub for I don't know how long?
Yeah, the USS Florida, they went out.
I don't think it says how long they were at sea, but yeah, they straight up hung out on a submarine for some amount of time. And on the way back, once they got wind of this, like, you know, runaway computer plot that they were trying to do, the Navy was like, that could never happen. The computer has no unilateral launch authority. And that's when they were like, well, I guess we have to write something else. And then the commander, one of the lieutenant commanders, it was the executive officer of the sub they were on, spent a ton of time telling them about the whole procedure that you see like four times in this movie of the orders come in, two people have to authenticate, the captain
snapping
blah, blah, blah.
That plastic.
Like, that feels like the most satisfying thing in the world, snapping that thing open, right?
Right. So like he basically took them to school on that whole procedure, and by the time they came out of getting back from that voyage, they decided to make the entire movie rest on that mechanism.
So I've seen some conflicting reporting as to whether the AI plot was ever actually a thing, or if that's what they told the Navy specifically so they could get in with them.
You may be right. Some of this stuff does read like maybe they were actually just not, they were being a little coy about what the movie was actually about.
The two technical advisors, according to the credits, were former captains of the Alabama.
Hmm.
Huh.
So they would know.
They would presumably ideally know. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
it reminds me of one of my favorite credits. Shout outs of another military movie, Sergeant Bilko, starring Steve Martin.
I did not expect that.
And I think in that movie, it says something to the effect of, the filmmakers would like to acknowledge the complete lack of cooperation from the U.S. Army.
Yep. Oh, man.
Listen, if the military doesn't think it's going to help their cause, it's going to help with recruiting, they're not necessarily going to get you know, sign off on it. But they got their sub shot anyway. They found a way.
That's right.
My last thing here is I'm just going to say this is the first movie we've watched where I've actually briefly, very briefly, extremely briefly, met one of the actors involved. I was at a book signing that Gene Hackman did in 1999 for one of the novels he wrote. This one was about 19th century tall ships, I think.
Oh, my God.
And my dad had the book, and he was getting it signed, and I remember... walking up, getting it signed, him kind of looking, going, "Eh," and that was about it. That was my Gene Hackman encounter.
Cool. That was about what I got when I met Buzz Aldrin and got a book signed.
Oh wow! Okay, that's better than Gene Hackman.
That's pretty good. That is pretty good.
All right. Well, Crimson Tide. It's in the books. I had a ton of fun. I'm glad you guys all did too.
Mm-hmm.
But we are not done with Sub Month. In 2 weeks, You know, in all the ways that Crimson Tide was a pretty brisk and moved along, we are about to go completely in the other direction as we watch the 3.5-hour director's cut of Das Boot. Das Boot, whatever you want to call it. I'm going to call it Das Boot a lot. Please don't yell at me if you're German, I ask. Give me some leeway here. That will be in 2 weeks. Drew, you will be joining us again for that one?
Indeed.
Excellent. Looking forward to it. As far as next week's show is concerned, our next Star Trek podcast will be the episodes What Are Little Girls Made Of? And Miri. So look out for those next time. As always, thank you for listening. Thank you for watching alongside us. This has been the Next Lander Watchcast. We'll see you next time.
Yeehaw!